Today, we have Patty Murphy Profiter with us. She's one of our appellate team. For those of you who joined us last month or have listened to it on the website, this is part two of her continuing talk on TPR issues. Patty has practiced in the law of child welfare for over 10 years. After teaching exceptional children for 8 years, she went to Wake Forest University School of Law with the intention of becoming a child advocate. Since then, she has practiced in the areas of domestic violence, public benefits, and dependency law. She was the managing attorney for the Domestic Violence and Public Benefits Unit at the Legal Aid Society of Northwest North Carolina. She was also a senior attorney for CWLS in Palm Beach County, and she's currently part of the appellate team for the statewide guardian ad litem office. She provided some materials that Liz sent out to everyone this morning. So, supervising attorneys, I would just remind you, if you did not forward that email to your attorneys, please do so now. And again, this presentation as well as the materials will be up on the website probably in about a week or so. We do not yet have the number back from the bar, so just hang in there and we will email it to you. There's some confusion because these were originally supposed to occur in August and September, but because of the hurricane, we bumped into September and October. So just pay attention to the details of the email because you may have to enter a different date than what the date that the CLE actually occurred. But we will provide that information in a further email. And at this point, I'm going to hand it over to Patty.
Thank you, and thank you all for being here. I'm going to put everybody on mute at this point, and then I will proceed from there, unless there are any questions before I do that. I didn't think there would be. Okay, I'm going to put you on mute then. Okay, assuming that worked correctly, I'm going to go ahead and start. Mary said, I am part of the appellate team for the Guardian Ad Litem program. That's a statewide program. And since we started a little over a year ago, we've seen all kinds of issues on appeal, procedural issues and substantive issues. Today, I want to discuss some important issues that were seen on appeal rather recently. Both of them that I'm going to discuss today are really based on due process issues, the right to be heard and to defend. Specifically, I want to talk about implied consents, which are also commonly known as defaults to termination of parental rights that are due to a parent's failure to appear, the resulting motions to set aside these orders, that's the second issue I want to talk about, and then finally, petitions for writ of habeas corpus, specifically when a parent misses an appeal deadline but wishes to pursue an appeal. So those are the three main issues that I'm going to talk about. Of course, because this is a conference call, I will need you to hold any questions, comments, and hopefully we'll have time even for some brainstorming at the end of the conference. So please bear with me and hold any questions or comments until the end. Okay, first I'd like to talk about implied consents for failure to appear. This is based on Section 30.39.801.3, and essentially, in general civil cases, a default cannot be entered when a party fails to appear, even if their counsel is present. That's not the case, though, in dependency or TPR cases. The absent parent is deemed to have consented to the entry of a judgment, even where only counsel shows up for the hearing. I know that probably all of us have seen at least one or two cases where the parents simply failed to show up. Where a parent does fail to show up for an advisory hearing, and I'm going to stick in this conference to talking about termination of parental rights hearings, where a parent fails to advise for the advisory hearing, the trial court is authorized to enter what is sometimes referred to as a default judgment. Just as an aside, the term default is not the appropriate term to be using in this context, even though I think it is done with frequency. The statutes and the rule refer to the parent's consent, and because the consent occurs through implication, it would more appropriately be referred to as either presumed consent, implied consent, or constructive consent. The case of TLD, which is cited on my outline, actually goes into some detail stating that. And I feel like implied consent is probably the most appropriate term, and so that's the one that I use. Okay, that being aside, Section 39801(3)(d) of the Florida statutes states, in essence, that if a person is served with a notice regarding the termination petition and they fail to personally appear at the advisory hearing, the failure to personally appear shall constitute consent for termination of parental rights by that person. If the person appears for the advisory hearing and then the court orders the parent to personally appear at the adjudicatory hearing for the petition for TPR and states the date, the time, the location of the said hearing, basically giving notice, then failure for the parent to personally appear at the adjudicatory hearing shall constitute consent for TPR. Okay, so basically the statute clearly gives the trial court the authority and basically the mandate. It says shall constitute consent to enter an order of implied consent when the parent fails to appear for these hearings. Initially for the advisory hearing, if the parent fails to appear there, but then the law also states that even if they come to the advisory hearing and the court gives them notice of when the adjudicatory hearing will take place and they fail to appear at that time, then the court can enter an order terminating their parental rights based on their implied consent. The problems that we're seeing, however, and the appeals that we're seeing regarding this arise in various factual scenarios. Basically, these are cases where the parents really are trying to appear and have a reasonable excuse for failing to do so. The courts do not want to terminate without an adjudication based on the merits of these cases. The appellate courts do not. They want an adjudication based on the merits whenever possible. Obviously, this should be understandable because these are really important rights that are potentially being lost. But basically what happens on appeal then is that the parents are coming back, and I'm going to get into this a little bit more in a minute, but coming back and saying, you know, I really tried to be here, and it was not my fault that I could not appear, and then they file a motion to vacate. But let me back up just a minute. The appellate courts have made it clear that the purpose of the statute that grants the trial court the authority to enter a consent where the parent fails to appear is not to terminate on a gotcha basis. It's only to ensure that the object of the termination petition is not defeated by the neglect of the proceeding by the parent. Basically, what they don't want is the parent who hasn't done really anything throughout the case to be able to not show up for the hearing, just like they haven't done for the rest of the hearings, and then somehow be able to delay permanency because they say, well, I wasn't there. So it's really a tool for the court to be able to assure that that doesn't happen. But it's not a tool to basically catch the parents when there's one case where the father arrived 22 minutes late to the hearing, and the trial court entered an implied consent and terminated his parental rights. That case was reversed because the appellate court found that the trial court abused its discretion, and rightly so, I'd have to say. Again, it's not to terminate on a gotcha basis. But what we're seeing is trial courts are simply entering an order based on the failure to appear, and in many cases, they're not taking any evidence or holding any type of hearing. They're basically just entering the order, and while that may be tempting and, again, might feel like it's the best way to get to a final order for termination and to do it as soon as possible, it's not the proper procedure. And in fact, this is likely and is delaying permanency for the child even longer because it's allowing for a reversible error. Again, most of the cases are being appealed where the ones that we're seeing on appeal is where the trial court has just entered the order and has not received any evidence supporting the TPR, notwithstanding the parent's failure to appear. In addition to that, the statute and case law are both clear that in an order terminating one's parental rights, of course, the trial court must contain findings of facts and findings of fact and conclusions of law. Obviously, you need evidence to do that. Okay, now, what should happen at these hearings? Basically, there's a case out of the 2nd District, CD versus Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services. It's also cited on the outline, but it's 711 South 2nd 600, Florida, 2nd DCA, 1998. In that case, the 2nd District Court of Appeal said that the trial court has two choices in the case where parents fail to appear. One is to proceed with the hearing by accepting testimony and evidence from those present, as well as argument of counsel, and that would include counsel for the absent parent, or to continue the hearing. So those are basically the two choices when a parent fails to appear, and those should be the two choices that the attorneys who are present look at to determine on a case-by-case basis what would be the most appropriate way to go in that particular case. Just as a side note, in CD, the trial court did neither. It entered a default judgment against the mother when she failed to appear, even though her attorney had requested that the trial court allow him to present argument. So that would have been the second choice, according to the appellate court, is to, the first choice, to proceed with the hearing accepting testimony and evidence. Instead, in that case, the trial court allowed the state to proffer its case concerning contested issues without requiring any testimony or evidence concerning the matters proffered, and then accepted then HRS's proffered statements of fact as being true and terminated mother's rights. And the second DCA found that that procedure was an abuse of discretion and reversed and remanded the matter. Again, how you decide which choice to advocate for in these particular cases is going to be case-specific, and hopefully we'll have time at the end to maybe talk about or brainstorm some ways to best reach that conclusion. Most of the cases that we're seeing on appeal deal with this particular issue, but actually it is the issue they are bringing on appeal is the trial court's refusal to set aside the order that terminated the parental rights based on a failure to appear, the implied consent. So essentially what has happened is the parent misses the adjudicatory hearing or the advisory or the adjudicatory hearing, and then at a later time, files a motion to set aside, hopefully in a timely manner. And then the trial court set a hearing, and they're supposed to hear basically the parent's reasons for why they missed the hearing. Because Florida public policy favors an adjudication on the merits over an entry of default, these properly filed motions to vacate an implied consent should be liberally granted. Okay, so the court should be having these hearings and liberally granting the motion if basically a three-pronged test, which I'll talk about in a minute, if those elements can be met. Again, this is the proper procedure, and there should be an evidentiary hearing held regarding the motion. At that hearing, the hearing to determine whether or not the trial court should set aside the order terminating the parent's rights based on implied consent, the movant has the burden of persuasion. The movant must persuade the court that he or she has acted with due diligence in filing the motion, that's the first prong, can demonstrate excusable neglect for failing to appear, that's the second prong, and can determine the existence of a meritorious defense regarding the underlying grounds for termination. So really, the third prong, the meritorious defense, is the only one that actually goes towards the underlying termination petition and the grounds therefore. I've had several cases regarding this particular issue, and all three of those prongs are necessary. So basically, the main case that really sets forth this test and does a good job of explaining it is TLD versus Department of Children and Family Services. It's also NRAAND. The site is 883 South 2nd 910. That's a second DCA case from 2004. And again, it sets forth a three-part test to vacate an implied consent. Now, the first prong, which is that the party seeking to vacate the consent order must act with due diligence, obviously that's going to be case-specific. Most of the cases I've seen where one of the parties is arguing that they did not act with due diligence is usually when the motion to set aside is filed 25, 30 days after the court entered the order. I was not able to find any particular case that deal simply with what due diligence is in that case, and I think that's a matter for the court to decide, and, you know, a reasonable test should be used there. The second prong, demonstrate excusable neglect. Most of the cases that I have read, this is where the trial court has denied the motion to set aside. Essentially, it's where the trial court, as the finder of fact, does not accept or does not find the move-in's reason for missing the hearing or for failing to appear to be credible. Okay? The last prong, to demonstrate the existence of a meritorious defense, that's a really important prong, because even if the party acts, or the move-in acts with due diligence, and again, remember, they have the burden of persuasion here, and can demonstrate excusable neglect in failing to appear, to demonstrate the existence of a meritorious defense, again, that goes to the grounds of the termination petition. And there is case law that has held, and I believe that would be the TLD case, that at a minimum, a meritorious defense should include any meritorious arguments regarding the grounds for termination, the manifest best interests of the child, and the least restrictive means of protecting the child. So that goes to basically the essential elements that must be proved in any termination case. So that is one prong. The third prong, I think, is probably the most important and will have the most evidence presented, because it really goes towards the heart of the actual TPR case. Again, the moving party carries the burden of persuasion. And the standard of review in these cases is an abuse of discretion, whether or not the trial court abused his or her discretion in denying the motion to set aside, or I guess I haven't seen any, but I guess in granting a motion to set aside, I haven't seen any of those. I guess those wouldn't be on appeal. Some examples, I've listed them on the outline. I'm just going to go over them very quickly. But some examples where the appellate court has found that the trial court did abuse its discretion by refusing to set aside or vacate an order based on the implied consent include Department of Children and Families. And that's the case where the father arrived 22 minutes late for adjudicatory hearing due, and the trial court refused to set aside the order terminating his parental rights, and the appellate court reversed. Another case where the trial court, where the court held that the trial court abused its discretion is RH versus Department of Children and Families. In that case, the father had, there was some confusion over the trial dates, and the court found that it was reasonable confusion and that the trial court abused its discretion in refusing to set aside his motion. And then another case, TB versus Department of Children and Family. In that case, the second DCA found that the denial of the father's request for a continuance was an abuse of discretion because due to father's inability to appear at a rescheduled hearing, which was beyond his control. And in that case, the father actually appeared for a scheduled trial date, and only to discover that the hearing had been rescheduled to the following day, without his participation, of course, or any notice to him. The father was unable to appear on the following day because he didn't have a driver's license, and he had not made provisions for overnight accommodations for his children, who were at home 9 hours away. The reason the trial court had rescheduled the hearing was due to a witness's inability to testify, but they refused to allow the father. They went ahead and entered an implied consent against the father, and the court said that also was an abuse of discretion. Remember, the courts are not supposed to be terminating the parental rights on a gotcha basis. And if that appears to be the case, then the other attorneys, should be objecting to that and asking either for a continuance or for an evidentiary hearing, basically an empty chair trial, where the attorney for the parent who is missing can at least participate in the trial, present any evidence that they can, so that this does not become an issue to appeal in addition to anything else that might be appealable. I'm going to move on to the next issue now because I want to make sure we have some time at the end to discuss some of these some of the things that we're talking about here. Another issue that we're seeing, again, more recently on appeal is the issue of habeas corpus, and I'm just going to be dealing with belated appeals because that's what is of interest to us. Essentially, the issue we're seeing is where the parent misses the 30-day window to file a notice of appeal, and the trial court enters a general order that allows the parents to pursue a belated appeal without really considering the elements that are necessary for habeas relief. As you may or may not know, the notice of appeal must be timely filed, 30 days from the rendition of a final order. This requirement is jurisdictional. Neither the appellate, the trial court, nor the parties can change that time frame. They're not authorized to extend the time frame for taking an appeal, and the parties cannot agree to extend the date for following. This appeal deadline is from Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure 911B. Okay, so that's one of the areas that comes up, is that this is jurisdictional. It's not something that people can just decide to say, well, it's okay, we'll extend that. So when that does happen, when a parent has, for some reason, missed their opportunity, the window of opportunity, which is the 30 days from rendition, to appeal, the proper vehicle for relief in those cases is to file a petition for a writ of habeas corpus. Now, a writ of habeas corpus is designed, it's a speedy method of affording judicial inquiry into the cause of the alleged unlawful custody of an individual. Most of us have heard of this in the context of criminal cases, but it has been authorized as a remedy for ascertaining a parent's right to the custody of his or her children. Okay, and the main case regarding this is In Re E.H., and that's at 609 South 2nd, 1289. It's a Florida Supreme Court case, 1992. Okay, the writ of habeas corpus should be filed with the trial court, and that's what the cases have established, because that permits resolution of any factual issues as well as any defenses, including those predicated on laches. Basically where the parent may have been sitting on his or her right to appeal. Okay, there should be an evidentiary hearing. The trial court must conduct an evidentiary hearing on the issue of habeas relief and needs to resolve the factual circumstances that underline the petition. Basically, if the trial court is just entering a general order saying, okay, the parent has the right to a belated appeal, then we should be objecting because that is not the proper procedure. The proper procedure is to file the petition for the writ of habeas corpus and for there to be an evidentiary hearing. This is, of course, unless the parties stipulate that the facts and circumstances are undisputed and there are no defenses, but we will talk about that in just a minute. So the implications for us is that if a parent misses the 30-day window to file an appeal, they need to file the petition for the writ of habeas corpus in the trial court. This petition should set out the facts that led to the parent missing the hearing, or I'm sorry, missing the notice of appeal deadline. And also, basically, those facts that are laid out in the petition need to be dealt with at the hearing. They need to set a hearing date, absent the stipulation, of course. And then any of the facts that allegedly led to the missed deadline must be proved by substantial competent evidence. Some of those factors would include, of course, that the missed deadline for filing the appeal was not due to the fault of the parent, but rather due to either ineffective counsel, the attorney didn't tell them that they could appeal or that they had to appeal within 30 days, or something, it may be very fact-specific, or somehow that the state has, or the trial court has somehow frustrated the appeal. The bottom line there is it can't be the fault of the parent. It can't be a parent who 35, 40 days after the appeal deadline has run comes back and says, you know what, I've been thinking about it and I really think that I want to appeal that case, or basically just has done nothing. It has to be somebody else's fault, basically. And there can't be any defenses. Again, it can't be just that the parents are sitting back and not doing anything, and suddenly they want to now, appeal this case that they weren't very interested in appealing over the last 30 days or even more. If you think about it, this all goes to the best interests of the child and our goal of permanency, because this could go on, if there weren't some very definite rules here, this could go on for an indefinite period of time. And, of course, the children are the ones who suffer because they're still in a state of limbo while they're waiting to see whether or not they're going to have a permanent, stable home. As far as the stipulation goes, that should only occur if and when all parties agree, or that the facts and the circumstances are undisputed, that there are no defenses to a belated appeal. In some cases, we're seeing where the court has entered an ex parte order allowing for a belated appeal. That should not happen. If there's a reason that everyone's going to agree or stipulate, that's fine. The attorneys simply need to get together beforehand, and then they can submit an agreed order to the trial court. But it is not sufficient for there to be an ex parte order. And, of course, we should object to that if that should come up. I'm going to check here real quick to make sure that I've covered most of the issues that I want to talk about. And then again, I'm hoping we'll have some time to brainstorm at the end of this. Okay. If in fact the attorneys are, or where you are approached to stipulate for a proper, for an agreed order regarding a habeas corpus, then there are several issues that you really need to think about before you're going to stipulate, okay? And if you don't meet these criteria, then you should object, and there should be an evidentiary hearing to deal with all these issues. One such issue may be that the parties knew that the parent wanted to appeal, okay? And again, that's fact-specific. That would be based on what happened at the trial or after the trial. You know, some evidence that we knew that the parent wanted to appeal. A second element, or not an element, but an issue to look at is whether or not we, and when I say we, I guess I'm just talking about the guardian ad litem program, also agree that the parent is not at fault for the missed deadline. That it wasn't that they just sat back, that somehow or someone else, either the parent's trial attorney, the state, the court, somehow, for some other reason than the parent's fault, the appeal deadline was missed. We should look to whether there was an unreasonable delay in filing the writ, because that certainly would go to whether or not the parent is at fault. And again, whether or not we had any plan to raise an equitable defense. If we have a plan or feel like we're going to raise a defense, then obviously we should not be stipulating. And finally, again, ex parte orders are not acceptable in this. And in that case, if an ex parte order has been issued, that should be objected to and set aside. And then a hearing should be set to actually go through all the factors, an evidentiary hearing to determine whether or not a belated appeal is appropriate in that case. I think I've covered rather quickly, I must say, most of the information that I have, and I would love to have some time to actually brainstorm regarding this.